From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Hello, I'm Rick Pantaleo for Carol Castiel. Thanks for joining me today for Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. The World Health Organization says nearly 800,000 people take their own lives every day. That's one person every 40 seconds. They say suicide occurs among people of all ages, from young children and teens to adults and senior citizens. Today, we'll talk about why people take their own lives and what can be done to help someone who is thinking of committing such a tragic act. Joining me today in studio is my longtime colleague and co-host, Carol Pearson, who is VOA's health reporter. Our guest today is Paul Gianfrido, president and CEO of Mental Health America, which is a community-based nonprofit organization dedicated to addressing the needs of those living with mental illness, as well as promoting the overall mental health of all Americans. Throughout a 30-year career, Paul has worked in a variety of health and mental health-related positions. Paul, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says that the rate of suicide in the U.S. increased by 25% between 1999 and 2016. Do you see this trend continuing?
Yeah, one of the most disturbing trends that a lot of people look at is in older men in the United States, seeing that the rates among older men increasing because, for the most part, nobody has anticipated these. Nobody has seen signs in 50-year-olds and 55-year-olds throughout their lives of suicidal ideation, for example. But equally important, frankly, is young people. And around the world, I think we have to look at the 15-year-olds. You've got to look at the 20-year-olds and try to understand what's going on in the lives of young people, which can be very distressing these days.
Yeah, and I understand. I mean, this is a global issue. It's not just a U.S. issue. The CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, reports in the U.S. that suicide is the 10th leading cause of death, and there's been a 25% increase since 1999. But the World Health Organization notes that 75% of all suicides occur in low- and middle-income countries. Do people globally commit suicide for the same reasons?
In many respects, they do. There's a difference from, you know, one culture to another culture sometimes, and economically, there can be a different set of, we'll call, proximate causes if you live in a society where there's a higher standard of living than you might have at that point versus the standard of living that everybody has, the expectation everybody has. But it all boils down to some of the same things at the end, and they have to do with distress and despair. And the feeling that either the people you leave behind or you will somehow be better off if you take your life. And I think they also go back into some of the earlier causes and earlier warning signs into people who are more likely to isolate themselves or be isolated. People are more likely to have challenges just maintaining their own health. People are more likely to have challenges maintaining their own mental health, either because they're poor or they're hungry or they live in a violent area or any number of sorts of things that lead to internal factors for people that kind of move people on a pathway towards suicide.
And the other thing, though, is that people who have mental health issues or mental illnesses are much more likely to commit suicide, aren't they?
Well, you know, almost by definition, that would be the case. In many instances, people would argue that suicide is the ultimate, you know, and I call this sometimes the ultimate stage four event for somebody with a serious mental illness. But the truth is that whether you're looking at the chicken or the egg here, you have to be willing to move upstream and look at what's going on in people's lives 5 years earlier, 10 years earlier, sometimes 15 or 20 years earlier, to have an understanding about what leads to suicide. And in the case of many mental health conditions, if we leave a serious mental illness untreated, we are going to increase the likelihood that somebody is going to die by suicide later on. That's just a fact.
Is there any such thing as a mental illness that cannot be treated or doesn't respond to treatment? Just a week or so ago, Rick and I were talking about this young woman who decided to end her life at age 27 because she could do it legally, because she had a mental illness and no treatment that she had tried to the point where she ended her life worked.
No, that's just sad. And the truth is, with any chronic disease or condition, sometimes they don't respond to any treatment. And that can happen with somebody with cancer. Somebody who's got a form of cancer can respond to all kinds of treatments. Somebody else who appears to have the same form of cancer might respond to no treatment. And so you can always pick up individuals and say, okay, in this instance, nothing that we tried worked. But in many instances with other conditions, we always still have hope that there is the next thing out there that will work. And people can get worn out and worn down over time. I often tell people that who say, boy, this really tests your faith when you have a chronic disease like this that's debilitating. And I say it doesn't test your sense of faith so much as it tests your sense of hope. And if you can remain hopeful and always have hope, then you're willing to try the next thing or to wait for the next thing to come along. But when you lose hope, and in the case of that young woman and people that I've known who've died even by suicide, who have had chronic physical conditions, when they lose hope, then we've really got a problem there. And that's the problem that we've got with a lot of mental health conditions. People think that recovery isn't possible. And we have to let people know that for the vast majority of people, recovery is possible. It all involves, just like it does with cancer, getting treatment early and then moving people along pathways to recovery early and not waiting until somebody's already thinking about suicide before we intervene and say, okay, now I want to try to prevent this.
Paul, you had mentioned and Carol had mentioned about mental conditions, mental illnesses as being a condition for people committing suicide. But what I'm curious about, Paul, is there are thousands, if not millions, of people worldwide who have different forms of mental illness. What seems to be a driving force to kind of push them over the edge to actually go through or at least attempt suicide?
I think the biggest driving force is the lack of treatment that they've had early on. We have a screening program, and I'll explain this with a little bit of data. We have a screening program at Mental Health America that people can go online, and they can use common screening tools. And we've had between 3.5 and 4 million people who have taken a screen this way. And so we have a lot of results. And the most frequent screening tool they use is called the PHQ-9. It's 9 questions that assess somebody's depression. And one of the questions of the 9 is a suicidal ideation question. Are you thinking about suicide? That's the 8th most frequently positively answered question. Okay, what do I mean by that? 8 out of 9. It means that people have severe depression. They could be responding yes to 7 other questions before they even think about suicide. And so when you ask for what's the biggest trigger, you know, when people have a serious mental illness, if you just look at depression, for example, where suicide is sometimes an outcome of depression, it's that all these other things have gone untreated all of this time. I mean, most of the people who take our screening tell us they've never been diagnosed, so none of these things are being treated. And so when we don't treat things early, then it becomes a trigger for later on. And the parallel would be with, say, a skin cancer, a melanoma. If you treat it early and, you know, when the mole changes and you take it off, you get a very high success rate and have always had a very high success rate. Well, until the last few years, if you waited and that went into your bloodstream and into your lymph nodes and got into other organs, then you had a very low probability of success. And right now, it's kind of like that with suicide. We've kind of let the early warning signs go. They've gotten into people's bloodstreams, for lack of a better image to use, and now they've nested elsewhere throughout the body. And that's pretty late to try to turn things around.
Paul, you mentioned suicidal ideation. Now, I have had personal experience with this because my husband and I adopted children who had been horribly abused before we adopted them. And when one of our daughters was 10 years old, we adopted her when she was 7. I mean, even when she was 7, she went into treatment. Yeah. And when she was 10, she was holding a knife to her stomach, saying, crying, and she did this for 2 hours, and crying, why can't I push it in? Why can't I push it in? And so she's been hospitalized, I guess, 3 times for suicidal ideation. My son's been hospitalized for it, too. They've been in residential programs to help them with their mental illnesses. But what makes a kid, young kids, 6-year-olds, 7-year-olds, 8-year-olds, a 10-year-old, try to commit suicide? Are there different reasons depending on the age?
There can be. And you and I have talked in the past about our families this way and our own children and these experiences that we've lived through as our children have lived through these challenges. And the reality is that, you know, as a six-year-old, and some six-year-olds think about this, and some 10-year-olds think about this and try it, you know, and do it, and as do some 15-year-olds. The reality is there usually you can find something different in the circumstances when puberty and adolescence hits, the fact that hormones go haywire, and that can exacerbate underlying problems or feelings that people have anyway. And so people can look at that, and that's historically what a lot of people have done. Say, well, of course, you know, among adolescents, among high school students. But then when you take them back and you say, but what about that 10-year-old or what about that 6-year-old? There is sometimes the triggering events that occurred when they were 2 or 3 years old that nobody worked through with them when they were 2 or 3. I mean, think about school shootings, another thing that people maybe can relate to a little better. When there's a bunch of 6-year-olds who are subjected to school shootings and survive that, that doesn't go away. They carry this with them forever. And if we don't address it, if we don't talk with them about it, work with them about it, then, you know, that could be the triggering event for both a 7-year-old saying, I don't want to live anymore because my friend died, but it also could be the triggering event, not just adolescence, when they're 10 years old or 12 years old or 15 years old. So we have to be careful at understanding each individual and what they bring with them to this, but recognize that there are some universal themes, like being subjected to abuse is just a universal theme sometimes that is more likely to lead to a mental health condition and a more serious mental health condition later on.
Let's take a break now. You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm your host, Rick Pantaleo. This is a reminder that Press Conference USA is available for free download from our website, voanews.com/PCUSA, or from iTunes. We hope you'll get in touch with us either through Facebook and Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or by sending us an old-fashioned email to pcusa@voanews.com. And now back to our program. Today, we're talking about why people take their own lives and what can be done to help someone who is thinking of committing such a tragic act. My co-host for today's program is VOA health reporter Carol Pearson, and our guest is Paul Gianfrido. He's the president and CEO of Mental Health America, a community-based nonprofit mental health advocacy organization based in Alexandria, Virginia. Paul, television, movies, and now other multimedia entertainment options like streaming offer up a host of some pretty violent content. What impact has this type of media entertainment had on children and their thoughts of suicide?
That's a really good question. And interestingly, the research that I've been able to find over time on this suggests that the concept here is that they bring in is this suicide contagion. And it came up with the show 13 Reasons Why. It's about whether or not that was glamorizing suicide would lead more kids to suicide, or on the converse, would actually help them identify peers and through entertainment. And what we find is that the notion of contagion does seem to be related to news media coverage. So if it's an actual case of suicide or actual reporting of suicides, that has been associated with an increase in the incidence of suicide among some defined peer group at that point. So it might be kids in the same area or people who do it or are in a virtual environment. But on the entertainment side, less so. That people seem to be able to understand that that's fantasy and that that's not as real. You know, that these are stories. These are not personal narratives. And so it doesn't seem to have the same effect, although we still need to be concerned about how much violence we expose our kids to.
Paul, connecting entertainment media aspect of it with a child's immaturity level,
Yeah. Do
you think a lot of the younger people committing suicide is more impulsive? In other words, hey, I'm mad at mom or dad, or I'm angry with my friends because they ignore me. I'll show them I'll commit suicide, and not realizing Right. That it's permanent.
Yeah, exactly. I think and hope it's the case that it's not typically truly impulsive. that when you look at it, even very young children, again, as I've talked about this in the past, you know, my son, I've been open about this, he has schizophrenia. He was diagnosed when he was a teenager, but his symptoms emerging was 5. But even young children, it's usually not just this impulsive thing. It may look and appear to be impulsive, but many times people will say, yeah, but we saw something else going on last year, or we saw something else going on earlier. And the good news in that is that that means there are frequently earlier warning signs. And the bad news is that we've done a really lousy job of educating us all to what those earlier warning signs may be. And when we do educate people to them, you know, we make them afraid that, oh, now we're saying your kid's crazy or your kid's going to do something really weird or dangerous. We got to step back and say that if we are willing to look at something like suicide openly, and even in young kids openly, and take away for the time being that sometimes we're just not going to be able to explain it because we just didn't know, but then look back and see what was going on, we have opportunities to intervene. And I think that's what's critically important for people to take away, even from some of those stories, that if it's not impulsive, that's a good thing.
Since you brought it up, Paul, I'm going to ask you, okay, what behaviors or warning signs for suicide should people look out for? How do you know someone is suicidal?
And I'm glad you've asked that, because what I talk to people about a lot is that you've got to look more toward internalizing versus externalizing factors. So a lot of times what people will say is, okay, when they hold a knife to themselves or to somebody else, or a milder form of that, when they act out in school or they get into fights and all that, they look at those external factors and say, okay, there's things I need to look at there, and there are. But if you want to look to earlier signs, what you're going to see is things like children who say that they have difficulty with friendship formation. They're saying it in different ways when they're 6 years old, but I don't have a lot of friends. But what you get from reports from other kids are other kids like them. And so they think they're engaging with them, becoming friends. But your child is saying, I'm not making friends. A child has a lot of trouble sleeping at night. A child who may get withdrawn in the course of even a school day. And we're not talking about kids who are just shy, but we're talking about kids who literally, in my son's case, he's still alive and he's had minimal suicidal ideation in his life, but he was described by teachers as crawling into a fetal position sometime in a classroom. You know, it's a little different than just sitting and being shy. And so if you look at sleep, if you look at eating habits, if you look at what they're saying about friendship formation, not just what you see with them playing with other kids, but how they feel about that and how different they feel from other kids, these are the kinds of things to look at. And if you start checking off not just one of these things or two, but you start checking off 3 or 4 or 5 boxes like this, then it's worth getting a checkup. You know, that's bottom line is, you know, you may get good news from your doctor that don't worry about this, he's okay or she's okay. But that's when it's worth going to have a checkup and just saying, okay, I've seen these 5 things. And I know they're all in the kinds of things that are in youth risk surveys or in PHQ-9. And can you help me with that? Because you should ask the next question, well, how am I supposed to know what's in a PHQ-9 or in a youth risk survey? One of the reasons we put these things on our website and let people take them for free and get results for free is so that people will know some of the things to look for that have been associated with suicidal ideation or mental health conditions later on, so they go in armed when they go see their pediatrician the next time or the school nurse or anybody they're following up with and say, okay, I know these things, these 5 or 6 things are related to more serious problems, so that's why I'm here. I'm not just making this up.
You know, you mentioned about the suicide and the media and coverage of news events. We've had some celebrities in the past several years who have committed suicide. However, I also know an advocate whom I've spoken to, and her position is we have to take the stigma away from this.
Yes.
And just like we have to take the stigma away from mental illness. So how do you cover something like that? Both of us are in the news business, Rick and I, and yet not put people at risk.
I think it's doing the kinds of things that we're doing here, the kinds of things that I see happening with greater frequency in the media in general. It's that you cover it, but you cover it in a context, and you cover it by offering people the opportunities to seek help or get help or go to places where they can get some help and saying it's okay to get help. And if the lesson that people get was even with a celebrity, because a lot of times the celebrity didn't get help. And so if they say, okay, this celebrity who I really admired was too proud or too shy or felt too much stigma to be able to go and acknowledge this and publicly or openly and to get help for it, well, I'm not going to do that because I'm now disappointed, saddened, distressed that we've lost them. I no longer have this person. So it's the reporting of it and then the reporting in the context of here are some ways to get help and a recognition that this is not, even though there's a lot of coverage about this particular one, it's not glamorizing it. We're not saying, you know, what a great thing this was in any way, shape, or form.
Paul, following up on Carol's question and talking about celebrities who've committed suicide, and recently there have been a number of high-profile people committing suicide. Have you come across any evidence or have seen evidence of copycats?
Interesting. Not as much on these more recent ones. And when I think about the copycat stuff, I think back to, remember there's a school outside of Dallas probably 20 or 30 years ago, and that high school, there was a suicide epidemic. And that was one of the first times that people really began to look at the notion of copycat suicide. And it did seem to people to be the case at that point, that it was such an unusual event happening in this high school in the Dallas suburbs. And that was the beginning, I think, of people understanding how are we reporting this and how do we need to report some of these events, because we don't want to sweep it under the rug. I mean, people do die by suicide, and we want people to understand that sometimes that has happened so that they can be alert to it and aware of the problem. But I think that more recently with the celebrity suicides that we've seen much less evidence. I'm not saying, you know, nobody went out the next day or the next week, but the fact that it, A, isn't reported, the copycats as much, and B, aren't put into the context of copycats, and then see the celebrities themselves are, again, it's being reported in a slightly different context. And for me, again, it's the same sadness when somebody dies by suicide as somebody who died of a stage 4 cancer. It's something that we realize in hindsight may have been inevitable in some way for them, but it's not like we all want to get stage 4 cancer. So when you start thinking about it that way, it's not like we all want to become so mentally ill, for lack of a better word, feel so bad, so hopeless, like that 27-year-old, that it seems like a good thing to get to that place. That just seems like a difficult path. We don't want to go there.
Are men and boys more vulnerable, and are they more likely to succeed when they attempt suicide?
Well, men and boys use different kinds of methods than women do, and men often will use a weapon to die by suicide, and so it's harder to turn that one around. If a woman's overdosing on something, sometimes you get stomach pumped and you can kind of reverse that. So yeah, the problem with men and boys is that what they often use, there's no stepping back from, and that's a problem for them. And when it's under-recognized, and I think suicidal ideation, mental health problems, men are less willing than women to come forward often. And when they do come forward, perhaps, you know, less willing to get help from other people, becomes a lethal combination if they then have access to a quick and easy way.
And men and boys are more likely to commit suicide using firearms, in the United States at least. When you have a lethal weapon, you're more likely to die.
There's no hedging your bet on that, and it is a problem. And there's no question that the availability of the means of suicide is a problem. But many people will say, and I think there's something to this, that if you didn't have that particular weapon and you were intent on suicide, you'll find a different means. And, you know, I have a friend who jumped off the Golden State Bridge, and so he survived that suicide attempt. But point is, he found a means to do it. And we just need to recognize that just taking away the tool, the gun, the bridge, that's something we can make all those things safer, right? But if we're really talking again about the underlying issues that are leading to this, we've got to look farther upstream.
Paul, we've been talking about some of the root causes for suicide and suicide itself. What about prevention? What if a family member or a good friend is displaying some of the warning signs that he or she may commit suicide? What do you do?
I think that the key thing, frankly, is first of all, getting information, becoming more informed about what's going on so that you've got a more precise way of describing what you're seeing. And then it really is trying to get help. And whether it's help from a clinician, and if you can't get that because nobody's taking appointments, then, you know, is there a peer support center in the community that you can call? It's just worth it to try to get some help. and studiously avoiding initially saying, telling the other person to get help, because figuring out how to do that so they don't react negatively to the suggestion is one of the most important things we can do for ourselves. So take a deep breath, understand what's going on, collect your symptoms, collect the thoughts, talk to somebody, figure out how to approach it, and have them help you approach the person to make sure that you can get the person the help that they need.
In the United States, at least, it has become apparent that people who live in rural areas are much more likely to commit suicide for a number of reasons, including lack of access to mental health professionals, or the hospitals are farther away, a number of reasons. Is there any movement to try to address that issue?
Yeah, this is where building virtual communities takes on greater importance. You know, we now have the tools at our disposal, and we use them here at Mental Health America, and others do too, of creating virtual communities, virtual neighborhoods, virtual environments online. And if you can do that, you can reduce the isolation of somebody and also engage in broadly telehealth solutions, not just the traditional, I can see a provider over the phone line or the video chat line, but actually being able to use things like social media and texting to get connected to people. That's the biggest opportunity we've got to begin to turn around people who are in more isolated or more rural areas in terms of finding both access to some kinds of beneficial help that they can get, but also just getting connected to people, because people in rural areas tend to be more isolated day to day than people in urban areas.
You mentioned social media. Now, social media can help, but can't social media also be a protagonist for somebody who is feeling suicidal? There are websites and there is information on how to do it.
Yeah, no, that's the great unfiltered internet that we have, but it's the world in which we live. And so what we have to be able to do is be on social media with good information and other alternative strategies as well, and to embrace it, because the world has embraced social media. Very few people, and certainly practically nobody under the age of 40 doesn't have some form of social media accounts, either through Facebook or Twitter or whatever. So recognizing that that's where people are, and recognizing that it can be lawless or it can be something that we work to set structure and boundaries around, that's our community. And these are our communities now. And so I think we have a role to play. So, yeah, there's some bad stuff that can go from social media. But the answer isn't saying keep everybody away from social media. I think the answer is let's get on social media ourselves. That's what we're doing at MHA, and we've got 500,000 followers. So we're on social media ourselves trying to make sure that we get this information out there in a useful way that's appealing and attractive to people.
Paul, we're just about out of time, but I have one final question about something that you rarely hear about, and that's help for the victims of suicide. Not just the people who commit suicide, but the survivors, the mothers, the fathers, siblings, friends, and so forth. I can't even imagine what it would be like to lose someone to suicide. How can you help these people?
I'm so glad you brought that up. I mean, these people have faced and lived through what we hope will be the most traumatic event in their lives. And while we have level one trauma centers all around the country to deal with injuries to physical health, there's no such thing as the concept of a level one trauma center to deal with injuries to mental health. Too often, we either tell people, figure this out on your own, or we give them short duration services in the aftermath of an event like this, or even broader ones, school violence and other things. You give them a month and you give them a couple of visits and you say, okay, now you'll get better. Well, we know that's not the case. So what we've got to be willing to do is go to the families and work with them over an extended period of time and really let them know that by experiencing the trauma they've experienced, they too have been harmed emotionally and have been, you know, their mental health has been diminished. And we don't want to leave that untreated, because all too often you hear stories of, you know, suicide running in families. And I just worry sometimes that the reason it runs in families sometimes is not just because of the genetics, not just because of the biology, but because of the environment that we created, where we said to the child, where you don't have to deal with that, it's over now that your parent is gone, or vice versa to the parent, it's over now. And then we find the same thing happening or repeating itself sometime later. So thank you for bringing that up. We've got to pay attention to the people left behind.
Paul Gianfrido, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us about this situation.
Thank you. My pleasure.
That was Paul Gianfrido, President and CEO of Mental Health America, a community-based nonprofit mental health advocacy organization based in nearby Alexandria, Virginia. And I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this edition of Press Conference USA. I'd like to thank my co-host for today's program, VOA Health Reporter Carol Pearson. And thanks to our studio technician, Aidan Utko. This is Rick Pantaleo reminding you to be sure to join Carol Castillo next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.